You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
Hey guys, super excited about today's episode. We're getting the opportunity to interview Sonny Burns. Now, Sonny is 28 years old. He works full-time as a project engineer for the Department of Defense, happily married, two boys. He writes over at famvestor.com talking about financial independence and creating strong families. The reason that I think that this interview is going to be so valuable for our community is that together with his wife, they own a rental property business with $1 million in assets, over $100,000 in annual gross rent. At the age of 28 years old, he says 88.86% FI, and he needs either 15,000 more in annual passive income or 387,000 more in net worth to officially reach his FI number. He says, I doubt I will still be working 9 to 5 by the time that I'm 30. And what strikes me is that so many people by the time of 30 are just waking up from that lost decade saying, I need to do something different. And so this interview, we're going to try and hit those inflection points. What choices did he make that is allowing us to have this conversation today? And to help me with this, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan, I'm doing quite well. And yeah, that 88.86%, that is absolutely hilarious.
Approximately.
You can get a sense of Sonny just from that. But talking about getting a sense of someone, just going to his homepage, I knew that I was going to like this guy. I saw an article on the 8 books that changed my life. And a lot of those were ones that I've read personally. He had an article on voluntary hardship, 21 challenges to reinvigorate your life. Man, this is my kind of guy. And I just can't wait to chat with him. So with that, Sonny, welcome to the podcast.
Hey guys, thanks for having me. And I just want to clarify, I'm now at 88.92% financial independence.
Moving on up.
No, I'm really excited to be here.
Awesome, man. Well, all right. So I thought what we could do, and honestly, it comes down to the fact that we are always talking about the lost decade. And I've identified in my own story that when I graduated with $168,000 in student loan debt, paying it off in about a period of 4 years, I was getting back to broke in my early 30s. You're getting to FI by 30. And you're doing it in a high cost of living area. I think you guys live in what, New York or New Jersey?
We live in northern New Jersey, but only 15 minutes from New York City. So yes, very high cost of living area.
So we need to rewind this a little bit. And I'd love to find out, like, where does your money story begin?
Right. So growing up, you know, I'm one of four siblings and my parents were kind of missionaries early on in life. So they didn't have a strong financial foundation getting started. So we just grew up without a lot of money. So we grew up very naturally to be frugal. Cheap, always the cheapest option we took. So I just naturally became very thrifty being raised in this household without a lot of money.
So, you know, when I did the setup, Sonny, for this, I was talking about the lost decade that I experienced. And I was dealing with basically a large student loan debt burden. In fact, I think when you look at the vast majority of our peers, people our age, maybe even younger, this is their biggest obstacle. They're graduating from college with six figures of student loan debt. And I'm wondering for you, your college story, like what were the financials of that choice?
Right. So I went to a pretty expensive college, actually, in Hoboken, New Jersey, Stevens Institute of Technology. I think it was like 35K tuition at the time, and that's without living on campus. So I decided to commute just to cut on living costs. And I bought a motorcycle because that was cheaper insurance and got good gas mileage. Luckily, my parents were poor, so I qualified for a lot of financial aid, but I was also a straight A student, so I got a lot of merit scholarships. In my junior year, I applied for something called the Department of Defense Smart Scholarship.
Oh, tell us more.
Yeah, so this scholarship, it's actually very little unknown. It's not widely spread. It provides full tuition and a $25,000 cash stipend in your pocket while you're going to college. So I got that from my junior year, my senior year. So in those 2 years, I got $50,000 from the government. That was $2,083 a month checks I was getting on top of my full tuition being paid. And, you know, so I actually graduated with a positive net worth from college.
So, Sonny, I guess my first question about the scholarship, is it only applicable for people in their junior year? If you had known, or I guess for the audience, Is this something that you could have earned as a freshman?
Yeah, you could apply. As long as you are enrolled in a college, you can apply. So freshman year is really the earliest you can apply for it. And I know a friend who just got it his freshman year. So for the next 4 years, he's going to be getting that stipend and his college is paid for.
That's amazing. So what do you do? What do you have to do to apply for this, to get approved for it? I mean, this is full ride plus 25K in your pocket. Like, I don't imagine this is something they just hand out. Do you have to sign up for X number of years with the DOD after graduation? Like, talk me through essentially everything about this. This is fascinating.
Right. So the main point of the scholarship, it's a recruitment scholarship trying to get top talent into the military, you know, working on R&D projects, scientists, engineers. So it's only for STEM majors. So any science field, engineering field, mathematics, physics, any of those fields. And in return for getting the scholarship, every year you accept, you have to work 1 year for the government. So I accepted for 2 years. I had to work for my sponsoring facility, which is at Picatinny Arsenal, New Jersey. It's an installation where it's all scientists, all civilians, and there are 6,000 civilians working on R&D projects, making armaments and things like that for the government.
All right. So you said this is for people in STEM fields. And I know you said you're going to the Stevens Institute of Technology. Is this for people at top tier technology schools? Like, I mean, are they recruiting from MIT and Caltech and Georgia Tech, places like that? Or is it basically if you're in any STEM field or major at any school in the country? Like, I'm trying to decide, is this applicable for a broad range of people, or is it just for maybe 5 or 10 colleges in the country?
Right. It's applicable for anyone. You just have to be in a STEM field and you have to have a 3.0 GPA. But I've heard really to qualify, you should really have a 3.5 or higher.
Well, that doesn't seem particularly arduous. And in fact, I'm just curious, let's say you're giving advice to your younger self. You don't have a 4.8 GPA, right? You got the 3.5 and you just really want to set yourself up to get this. Is there anything you can do to increase your odds substantially over someone that maybe didn't listen to this podcast?
So the biggest advantage I think I had was I had previously interned at Picatinny Arsenal, which was that DOD facility before. So I had my supervisor write me a reference letter. But again, I've had friends who've applied and gotten in and they just had a reference letter written by just some military service person from their family. So like someone who was a retired vet from the Army wrote him a letter and he got in.
That's incredible. I've never heard that mentioned before. And we got to add that to the list of now these small outlier type scholarships that our community has increasingly become aware of. I mean, this is really valuable information. Let's go back and talk about the economics for you with the school that you chose and the scholarship that you landed. First of all, just go through again. What did this scholarship offer? How valuable was this while you were in school?
Yeah. So, I mean, I didn't have to worry about tuition anymore. So full tuition is paid. Again, they don't pay for dorming fees, but I was commuting from home, so I didn't have that expense anyway. And on top of, you know, free tuition, you're getting paid $25,000 a year. That was $2,083 a month checks coming in, and they also pay for books.
All right, so now, what year did you say that you were actually able to land this scholarship?
Junior year.
All right, so you still are responsible for your freshman and sophomore year. Did you take out student loans for those?
Yeah, so I graduated with about $15,000 in student loans from that freshman year and sophomore year because I worked all throughout freshman year and sophomore year and actually started a car flipping business where I was buying used cars off Craigslist and flipping them while I was going to college just to fund the tuition that I did have to pay that I didn't have student loans for.
I have my hand raised, Brad. I have to ask a question here.
I thought you might have one.
Wait a second. You said that this college that you were at was $35,000 a year. So for those first 2 years, I'm putting that at $70,000. You're saying you're only graduating with $15,000 in student loan debt. Like, how is that possible?
Luckily enough, my parents were poor, so I qualified for a lot of financial aid. And I was smart, so I got a lot of merit scholarships from this private school. Because a lot of private schools have a lot of funding, so they want to get smart kids. So they gave us a lot of merit scholarships.
All right. So, Sonny, obviously, Jonathan wants to ask a million questions about the car flipping. But just real quick, you had about $15,000 in loans, but as I'm understanding it, you got paid $50,000 over your final 2 years. Did you invest that money or did you consider paying off those loans? Talk me through that thought process.
Okay, so I knew I was going to have to work for the Department of Defense for 2 years. The Department of Defense and most federal jobs have tuition repayment programs. So every year you work for the government, you can apply for the student loan repayment program, and they'll pay up to $10,000 a year in student loans. So I'm like, I'm not going to pay down my student loans with my cash. I'll wait for the government to do it. So that's why I didn't pay it down immediately. And yes, the government has paid off all my loans now for me, that $15K.
This is the story that keeps on giving, Sonny. You realize that sometime in junior or senior year that, I mean, most kids at 20 or 21 aren't looking that far down the road. Like, how did you even come across that that was one of the benefits of working for the DOD?
Right. So I had previously interned there and I just love the environment there. You know, everyone's just working 40-hour work weeks. You know, when I graduated, most of my peers are working 60-hour work weeks and I didn't want anything to do with that. All my supervisors were like family first. You know, my supervisor had four kids. So my plan was to have a good family. And I love that freedom environment. You got 13 vacation days immediately. Within 3 years, you get 20 vacation days. And then within 10 years, you get 26 vacation days. And I was all about that. So there were just so many perks for working for the government. And that's what I wanted to do.
All right. You know, you almost have to choose, Sonny, with your story, because there's so much here. Like it could be a 3-hour episode. We're not gonna do this for 3 hours. But I thought what we could do, let's move out of that college to your first job thing just for a second and circle back. Let's rewind in time and talk about the car flipping, because I only lose money on cars. Brad loses less by having one car for 45 years. You might be the first person I've ever met that's like making money on cars. Tell us about flipping cars. What did this look like for you and how does this relate to your money story?
Up to this point, I've owned 19 cars in my life and I've sold 17, you know, and I'm only 28. And most of that was done before age 24. My dad always told me growing up that he will not pay for my college. He said he had the worst experience in college and he's not going to force me to go to college, but he's definitely not paying for it. So I had to figure out some way to pay for college. So when I was in my senior year of high school, I started working. I had this idea that, hey, maybe I can start flipping cars because I had bought my motorcycle. I bought it really cheap for $2,000 and I knew next day I could have sold it very easily for $3,000. And that was just through searching through Craigslist. So I'm like, if I do this with cars, I can start flipping them. I can start making profit. But the problem was I had no capital. In my senior year of college, I started working at Taco Bell. I worked there for 6 months. I told myself, 6 months, I'm going to build capital, and then I'm going to use that capital to start this car flipping business. And that's just what I did. You know, I gave, at the end of my 6 months, I gave my 2 weeks notice, and that very same day, I bought my first car. It was a 1999 Mitsubishi Mirage, had 115,000 miles on it. I bought it for $1,400 cash, and 2 weeks later, I sold it for double what I bought it for $2,850.
How did you know to do this? Like, genuinely, This isn't just obvious. Like, how did you know there was margin there? Like, I mean, were you listening to podcasts at this particular point in time? Did you read this on a website? What inspired you to think that this was a viable strategy?
My dad, a lot earlier on, I mean, he wasn't that into it, but like every once in a while, he would see a cheap deal because we used to go to this Japanese supermarket and there was all these Japanese high-end people coming in, working for a little bit and then leaving. And at the time, they would just have ads with these cars. And he knew like, oh, this car is so cheap on this ad at this Japanese supermarket. I'm going to buy it and I'm going to flip it. And he did that maybe 3 or 4 times in me growing up. So I guess maybe that idea was planted in my mind at that time. And then when I bought that motorcycle, it just all clicked. You know, wow, I can search through Craigslist. I'll find these great deals that are under market, be the first one there with cash, buy it, and then, you know, sell them without having to do too much to them.
Yeah, Sonny, this is wild. I'm seeing here on this article you have on your site, you've got this nice little screenshot here of an Excel document that you have. You own that Mitsubishi Mirage for 12 days. It looks like the shortest one that you own was for 5 days.
Right.
A Nissan Altima, you had a 195% profit margin.
Yeah, that one was my best, well, pretty much my quickest deal, let's say. So I bought that, it was a 1994 Nissan Altima for $700. And then within 5 days, I sold it for $2,100. So that's triple what I bought it for. And the only reason it took 5 days to sell is I was on a trip to Washington, D.C. I think it might have been for the Smart Scholarship. They had their orientation in Washington, D.C. So I had to wait to come back to give the title over and things like that because I had listed on Craigslist and then I went on the trip and then I came back and exchanged the keys and the cash.
So, Sonny, you know we're always looking for actionable tips. How does someone listening to this actually get into car flipping if they're interested? It looks like the average amount you paid was $2,250. So we're not talking like massive capital, like, and there's not a huge downside, I imagine, right? So this is actually kind of a side hustle that people could get into if they knew where to start. Can you give like just a couple of quick little actionable tips of like, hey, these were the places where I found great deals, or this is what I was looking for?
pretty much every single car I bought was off Craigslist. Now I would use Marketplace, but that wasn't around, Facebook Marketplace, but that wasn't around at the time. I got kind of mechanical after doing this car flipping business because I did have to learn how to do little tweaks here and there. I would change spark plugs, do oil changes, but I tried not to buy fixer uppers. I just tried to find cars that had really good deals. It was just people who didn't care. You know, it's a 10-year-old, 15-year-old, 20-year-old car. I just want to get rid of it. You know, I just bought myself a brand new car. This I just want to get rid of. What I would recommend is for people who really want to do this is to have your cash and be the first one to show up. So I would spend, you know, maybe an hour or two a day, probably an hour a day, just looking at the ads and looking as they came up, because good deals go quick. So I would look through the ads. When a good deal came up, I knew it was a good deal just from searching so long. I would call them up and be like, hey, can I come over in 30 minutes? I'll be over with cash. I'll show up with my parents' car's license plates that I would take, and I would just be there, give them the cash and take the car home. Yeah.
Maybe this is like my naivete, but I actually like feel like the process to purchase a car is maybe a little bit more complicated than it maybe actually is. Walk me through this like step by step. You show up, you're at their driveway, you have your $2,000 in your envelope cash, and you're saying, I'm going to make this as convenient as possible. Like, what else goes into this? I mean, do you need to give them a bill of sale? Do you need to go with them to the DMV? Do you have to file as a dealer status because you're flipping a certain number of these? Help me out with some of the stuff that I just haven't thought through here.
Yes, legally, what you would do is you would go over there and you would make the deal. Maybe you would write out a bill of sale. I've done that a couple times, depending on, you know, the seller and how comfortable they were. Like the very first time I went, that's the first time I bought that Mitsubishi Mirage. I met the guy. We actually went to the DMV that same day because he had an expired inspection. And I knew with that expired inspection, it would be hard for me because I'd have to then title and register the car. I'd have to insure it so I could drive it over to the DMV and get my own inspection. So I asked him, hey, can you actually just come with me to the DMV real quick? I mapped it out. It's only 15 minutes away. Can we sit through the inspection line, get it inspected, and then you sell me the car? That's what we did. And the reason I say that is because when you have to title the car, when you have to register, and when you have to insure it, you have all these additional costs that eat into your profit. So what I like to do is just title the car and just inherit the title. And then I'm only paying that title fee with the 7% in New Jersey sales tax on whatever you paid for it.
Sonny, you said something in there, inheriting the title. I honestly don't know what that means. As I've seen it with my own car, I have the title. I can literally sign it over. Like, is that what we're talking about, inheriting the title?
Right. So sometimes the seller would be comfortable with just driving the car over to my driveway and then just signing under his name. It's almost like a wholesale deal. Like he would sign under his name as seller that he's selling the car. And then when I would find a buyer, the buyer would just fill in his name. And that was just a way for me not to have to go to the DMV and pay that 7% once. And then when the new buyer came and bought it, he would have to pay 7%. Sometimes the seller didn't want to do that. He wasn't okay with that wholesale deal. So I would just eat it. Take the title, sign as buyer, take it to the DMV, get my own title, and then hand that over to the new buyer.
All right. So, you know, you are 88.92% FI. I suspect that like you didn't hit that just through car flipping, although it's a great side hustle. I feel like there's probably a limitations on scaling this as an individual user. I am curious though, like if you were to bundle all those deals together, how much were those 17 flips worth to you over that period of a year or two that you were doing this?
My average profit on all 17 cars was $1,000. So it was about, you know, $17,000 in, I think I did it mostly in like 3 years or so. So it was a good amount of money. It was enough I needed to fill in that gap between my student loans and the amount I needed for tuition.
And you said that this wasn't something that was taking up a tremendous amount of time. You were looking through like, you know, a couple hours a week. Is that about right?
Right. A couple hours a week when I had spare time, I would just glance at the ads.
Nice, man. This is really cool. Well, as I just kind of did the setup, I realized that this was not your main vehicle to fly, but it's indicative of this talent stack that you're putting together, that you're looking for margin in these different places. And I know that as I was looking through your story, a big piece of this is real estate. How did real estate come into place for you on your path to financial independence?
My parents actually didn't buy their first house until I was age 22. Other than that, before that, we were renting the whole time. And then finally, my parents bought a $250,000 house around this area. I was looking at their mortgage statement and I saw, you know, over the next 30 years at their 4% interest or whatever it was, they would be paying like $750,000 in interest and principal payments. And I'm like, wow, they're going to be paying triple what they bought this house for. at the time, you know, I didn't know so much about leverage and leveraging real estate. And I was like, oh, I never want to pay triple. I don't want to pay $500,000 just in interest. I'm going to save up as much money as I can when I'm older, and I'm just going to buy my house outright. That was my thought. And I had no idea how to buy a house. So once I started getting all these smart scholarships, I started getting capital. I had to start thinking about maybe I do want to buy that house outright eventually. So I started researching, and I was into podcasts at the time, and I just searched on my podcast, how to buy a house. And then this real estate investment podcast came up called Bigger Pockets. And I just started listening to it. And it just gave me this idea about real estate investing that I'd never heard of before, never known anyone to do it. And every episode, they just interviewed a different investor. And I'm like, wow, this is awesome. I can buy a rental property, live in one side of one, like a 4-unit property, live in one unit, rent out the other three, and then essentially live for free without ever having to worry about my housing cost.
So what's crazy is I was also listening to Bigger Pockets, but I didn't take action on those ideas. You did. Tell us about this. Like, you decided to get a house hack. How did you find the deal? And I know you said you're married. Was your wife on board with this?
Yeah, so it took a little convincing, and I guess there's a lot more steps involved in between, because, you know, a house, you need a lot more capital than a car. So a car is very low barrier to entry. You know, I just needed $1,400. I think I only had $1,500, and I could get into this business. Very simple. With a house, yes, there are some 0% down programs, but those are risky, I would say. And I mean, it sounds like I'm a risky person, but I try to mitigate as much as possible. So I wanted a solid down payment. So actually, you know, when I graduated college, I started working for the DOD. I was getting paid $50,000 as an engineer. My wife was getting paid as a teacher. She started as well as an elementary art school teacher. She was getting paid $50,000. So we were making about $100,000 each gross salary. And, you know, we really want to save money for our future. So we decided just to live in my parents' house. In their one bedroom, we gave them a cheap rent, $500 a month in rent for their little one bedroom they rented to us. We just hunkered down with our $100,000 coming in and saved as much as possible. And in 2 years, we were actually able to save $75,000. And that was enough for us to put on down payment on the house. And, you know, that was a sacrifice, because this is a smaller house, you know, a $250,000 house in this northern New Jersey area. And we had 9 adults, because I have 4 siblings and one of them is also married. So it was 9 adults in this one house with one bathroom. So it was a sacrifice we made kind of towards investing in our future and eventually this plan to invest in a rental property.
Hey, Sonny, you said something in there that really struck me. You said, it sounds like I'm a risky person, but I'm not. I'm calculated and I think through this. That's how I view you. I mean, you're buying all these cars, you're selling them, you're doing this house hacking, you're doing all these different things that might appear unusual to people in normal life, but obviously to people in the FI community, like, this is sensible and this is normal. Do you get pushback in your real life about all these different plans that you have going?
Right. Like with the rental properties, for sure, it's like, oh, I could never have a tenant. What if they do this? What if they, you know, leave the water running and then your whole house gets flooded? What if they burn down your house? What if they sue you? Everyone's going to sue you. Oh, your sidewalk. Oh, they're going to sue you. Everyone just has a reason not to get started, has an excuse why they are where they are and why they can't do that.
Everyone has an excuse. What a perfect way to put that. People don't take action. And whereas like you, another thing that I just caught that you said a minute ago, I was looking at my parents' mortgage statement. I mean, who does that? That's cool. And that's indicative of who you are. So yeah, just really, really impressive stuff.
So to clarify, the house hack was not your first step. In order to save up enough to get the house hack, your first move was to, you moved back in with your parents. And it was you and your wife that moved back in with your parents, right?
That's correct. So both of us joined my family and lived in that one bedroom, tiny apartment for the next 2-3 years.
Wow. And were you paying them rent in that period of time?
Yeah, we were giving them $500 a month, you know, which they were very happy to receive and we were very happy to give.
All right. So this is one of those quote unquote, you know, hard choices. But Brad, give me the full quote so we can kind of get a sense for where this is going.
Yeah, it's easy choices, hard life, hard choices, easy life. And we heard that from Jersey Gregoric on the Tim Ferriss podcast.
And to tie that together, because like you and your wife together are making a pretty good income once you combine it, especially in the context of a low cost of living in this particular area, your savings rate is through the roof. You're actually able to put together $75,000 and you have this goal in mind of saving up for your first house hack, an idea that was inspired for you by the Bigger Pockets podcast. Tell us about the process of actually finding this house hack. Did you pick a single family? What did you guys end up doing?
So we looked around, and in our area, taxes are just through the roof. My parents actually got lucky. They are paying only $7,000 a year in taxes. But most of the surrounding areas, you know, you're easily going to be paying $10,000 a year for just a single family house. But what we saw is when you get a two family house, you know, you're not really paying that much more in taxes. When you get a three or four family, it also doesn't go that much higher. For a four family house right now, all we're paying is $11,000 a year in taxes. And that's 12 bedrooms. That's 4 3-bedroom units. You know, so that's only $1,000 a month going out to taxes as an expense, as opposed to buying a single family where you'd still be paying pretty close, like a $10,000 expense. And it's just so much harder to scale. So that's why we decided we want to go for a four family house or a three family. So we were just looking around for a three or four family house in the area. And that was why we did that.
Sonny, a 12-bedroom house in northern New Jersey, just outside of New York City, like I can't imagine that's very inexpensive. What kind of price tag are we talking here? You sound like a guy who's prepared. Was this just on a whim, or did you have every bit of data down and you knew to jump on this particular one?
Yeah, I'm an engineer, so I have tons of spreadsheets. I was analyzing deals. We were looking for over a year and a half before we finally stumbled on this deal. And, you know, we were going to open houses. We were calling listing agents, going inside properties and just searching for a year and a half. We did put in a couple offers, but we kept getting rejected because it's a competitive market. A lot of people want these income producing rental properties. And, you know, we want to find a home, but also find this rental income. And so we were putting in offers. We even put in a $25K over asking offer, and we got rejected because there's people putting in all cash offers well over ours. So finally, we stumbled on this deal, which we live in right now, this four family in Garfield, New Jersey. And we closed in October of 2015, but it was an REO property. It was bank owned. And for the first 12 days, they were only going to let people who were going to live on the property bid on the property. It was, I think it was through Wells Fargo. They have like home path programs where, you know, they want people who are going to live on the property to put bids in and encourage that kind of growth and take care of the property. Because if you live on the property, they figure you're going to have pride of ownership and you're going to take better care of it than an investor who's not really there. That's how we kind of had that competitive edge in this really competitive environment. We were able to go in, we contacted the listing agent directly. You know, if we contact the listing agent, they're your buyer's agent, but they're also the seller's agent. So they're going to get a double commission. So they were very happy to work with us and encourage us to buy this home. So we went in and we put in an offer on this four family house. And we were only one of three offers, even though every day we went to this property after finding it, we would see like 20 investors walking around trying to get into the property because it was such a good deal. But they couldn't put an offer in because they already had a primary residence and they couldn't owner occupy this home.
All right. Well, I have a barrage of questions for you, unshockingly. All right. Let's start with you said that you had to make bids on it, but there was actually a listing price, correct?
Correct. It was listed at $475,000. And we were prepared to put 10% down. That's what we were pre-approved. So $475,000, that's $47,000 we would have to bring to the table.
Okay. Now, what's amazing about this is because you were actually house hacking as opposed to being an investor, you had a leg up using what you, I believe you called the Wells Fargo Home Path program. Is that a program that's still in place today?
I've looked at Wells Fargo maybe 2 years ago, and I didn't see too many REO properties at that point with that 12-day stipulation. But there are that still exists where you can find that short window where only owner occupants can put bids in.
Yeah, it's an incredible advantage for people that are actually looking at leveraging this house hacking. If they can do that, they'll be able to snipe in front of all the other investors and get access to these deals before they get exposed to the broader market. That's really remarkable. The other thing I wanted to mention, you're an engineer. So I know that you're very well aware of the numbers. And I would imagine that I was kind of surprised to hear you say 10% instead of 20%, just because, you know, obviously with 20%, typically that's when PMI rolls off. Did you have PMI rolled into this equation? Like how did that go?
No, that was the beauty of it. We didn't have to pay PMI. We found this small bank. They only operate out of, in New Jersey, at least, they only operate out of Bergen County. They're called Trusco Bank. And they were offering for up to a four family property. You can just put 10% down and there's no PMI, really competitive interest rates. We're at a 3.49% interest rate. So it was just win-win-win, low closing costs, no application fee. And yeah, and that was just through kind of talking to people and finding, you know, the best lending solution.
So Sonny, at the end of this, you've got a 4-unit place. You're obviously living in one of the units. You've got to find renters for the other three. Talk me through that process. How quickly did you ramp up to having all three units occupied? Talk us through like the actual nuts and bolts of how this works as a business.
So an REO usually is a foreclosure that the bank buys back and then sells back to someone. So it was completely vacant. A lot of times when you look at rental property, there's still tenants involved and you inherit them on purchasing the property. There's pros and cons. You know, we bought it vacant so we could place our own tenants, which I actually prefer. But the problem is you have all these holding costs because now you're buying this expensive. It was listed at $475,000, but we ended up buying it for $430,000. We found an oil tank on the property, so an oil tank that was buried underground that had been decommissioned, but we couldn't close on the house until we dealt with it. So we went back and forth with the bank. Originally, they said that they would pull it out for us. Then they said no. So I said, okay, if you're not going to pull it out, then you got to give us $50,000 back at closing. So we had offered $480,000, and I said, you got to give us back $50,000 back at closing if you want us to deal with this oil tank. And I mitigated my risk, you know, because again, sounds really risky to inherit this oil tank, but I mitigated it by doing oil sample tests. We hired a company. They drilled soil samples around the oil tank. They confirmed that it was decommissioned, and they came back with clean results. There was no oil spillage around the soil around surrounding the tank. So I felt I mitigated my risk. We got $50,000 off the property. You know, $1,000 a month has to go to taxes. You have this now mortgage, and all these expenses add up. And if you don't have rental income coming in, it's all these holding costs that are really painful. We decided to take the very worst unit because the other units were in decent shape. So we moved in a tenant almost immediately. And actually, that tenant was my in-laws because they had just sold their house and they needed a place to stay. So they moved in at the day of closing. They were living in like a hotel waiting for us to close. And so they moved in immediately. And we gave them kind of a good deal on rent. Probably could have rented for $1,500. We gave it to them for $1,000 a month. And then we started renovating the other two units just to get them ready to rent out. And it took us about 3 months, actually. So 3 months, they were left unoccupied as we're renovating the units. I hired some contractors, did some of the work ourselves. But we finally eventually rented out the units for about $1,700 each unit. And we market them on Craigslist. We market them on Zillow Listing Manager. So Zillow goes to Hotpads, Trulia, Realtor.com, all these other places. We would hold open houses just because we didn't want to be on these tenants' schedules. They'd be saying, oh, I hear all these nightmare stories. Oh, I'll be there at 5 o'clock. And then they never show up. So we decided we're just going to do open houses. So we were at the properties on Saturday, Sunday, and then a weekday. And then we'd have all these groups coming in and they would come check out the property. We had strict requirements. You need to make 2.5 times the rental amount as gross income to qualify, and you need over a 630 credit score. And we did a background check and we confirmed it by doing a credit score check. So we had all these requirements in. So it took us 3 months to finally place the tenants and get those rents coming in and finally breaking even, actually cash flowing a little bit while we lived there for free.
With these tenants, it sounds like you had this fairly strict process. It took you 3 months to get ramped up, but you also talked about the holding cost. So obviously there was an opportunity cost to this, hoping there's an upside. Did you find that you got better tenants? Have they stayed for longer than average? You're an engineer, right? Like, have you quantified whether that opportunity cost was worth it?
I think it's definitely worth it because all the nightmares of landlording or house hacking comes from dealing with tenants. And I feel like it's definitely worth it to go through the process. We know we had two weekends of open houses just to, you know, we probably had like a pool of like 40 applicants. We picked the highest financial requirements and, you know, they're great people. We have them as neighbors now and we have friends. You know, we play board games with them some nights. We've gone on retreats with them. So they're really cool, great people that, you know, we've become friends with over time. And I think it's just so important. You know, if you have that good tenant relationship, they tell us when something's wrong, we fix it immediately. We have this great rapport and they're just happy to be our tenants. And I think if we had just been like, oh, we got to rent this place out immediately. We got to cut our losses and just pick the first person that crossed the road, didn't do a background check, didn't do a credit score check. We would have just had nightmares. And, you know, these tenants are still with us. And yeah, it's just been a great process.
So long-term tenants then, right? Your vacancy rate, once you have them in place, I would imagine is relatively low.
Right. One did end up buying a house. So she moved out and then we had to bring in another couple. And there was only 3 days of vacancy because we quickly painted the unit. And within 3 days, we were able to occupy it with that next tenant. And we went from $1,700 a month to $1,815 a month with that new tenant.
That's amazing, man. Congratulations. Let's go back and talk about how this ties to your path to financial independence. So place us, I think the year is 2015 when you're getting this house hack. What was your net worth, you know, after you guys had landed it and before you'd kind of gotten everything up and rolling?
We had about 100,000 saved at that point, just from the scholarship and the 75,000 we had saved. And so we poured a lot of money in because, again, we put 10% down. So that was 43,000 down. And then we've had $10,000 in closing costs. And then we were renovating. So we had poured about $67,000 total dollars into this property. So our net worth kind of went down. But then within 6 months, we did a cash out refinance. So we went from $430,000 house to then it appraising for $630,000 because, you know, we had upped the rent. We had made it look nice. You know, numbers were cash flowing. So it went from $430,000 to $630,000. That's $200,000 over what we bought it for. And we were able to pull out $67,000 in cash to use to recuperate all those costs and use it for our next property.
So I just want to clarify, you're saying that your net worth after that process was right around $160,000. That's where your net worth was towards the end of 2015.
I would say end of 2015, right when we bought the house, we only had like $100,000 to our name.
Okay, can we just pause? Like right now, we're recording this 2019, and you have $1 million in assets, so that's the properties, and you have over $100,000 a year in gross rent, and you are 90% of the way to financial independence. This was the force multiplier, right? It was the fact that you were able to make this one decision based on a hard choice that you had made a few months or for a couple of years to save up that initial amount, but now you're living for free. You've cut your living expenses by well over 50%. And on top of that, it's scalable, right? This is for instead of the car flipping now, you're now focusing on real estate. And like, just walk us through that. Did you purchase any other real estate after that point?
Like I said, we did that cash out refinance and we went from a 4% mortgage to a 3.5% mortgage. And we had $67,000 back now. So what we did is we started looking around for our next property. You know, it was hard to find deals. Like I said, it's a very competitive environment. So I was looking for through Craigslist again, and I found this for sale by owner house. It was a 3-family house, 15 minutes from our current property, also in New York City surrounding area. And it was listed at $375,000. I called the owner of the Craigslist ad and I said, hey, you know, we're interested. We met up that same day and I offered him $350,000. So we bought that 3-family house for $350,000. And that was in August of 2017. So that was about 2 years later.
So, Sonny, I have one general question. It sounds like you've done a ton of research. You obviously know what you're doing, clearly. I'm curious on the background of why you've decided to keep investing in your high cost of living area. Is it just success and you're able to find deals? Like, have you thought of investing outside of, I guess, your immediate proximity? Talk me through that, because I think myself as a real estate investor, I am somewhat agnostic as to like where I purchase a future property. Like, and I'd love to learn from someone like you who's done this, why you've decided to buy both in a high cost of living area and close nearby.
I mean, I hear so much about people doing it from afar. I've never really even thought about it. For that first place, you know, we all need a place to live. So house hacking just makes sense. You know, if you get your housing expenses paid for, then, you know, most of your salary you can start saving if you're a frugal person. So it just makes sense to house hack in where you live. For that next property, you know, we just love the process of meeting, you know, our tenants, screening them well, being on site to manage the contractors or do the work ourselves. And we were able to find these good deals. So we found these under market deals that appreciated really well. So $430,000 appreciated $630,000, $200,000 in appreciation. We bought that other 3-family for $350,000. It just appraised for $525,000. So significant appreciation there. So we're finding these under market deals and we're able to do that because we're on site. We can see, you know, oh, it's actually not that bad. It's a pretty good property. It's just listed. It's not listed to the masses, is listed on Craigslist. So it was a good deal that we could take advantage of, you know, similar to what I did with those Craigslist deals.
I'm hearing obviously these amazing numbers, $1 million in assets and $100,000 in gross rent. But I'm curious, when you get down to the nuts and bolts of it, what's the net income from these rental properties? And like, what's your net worth out of these, like assets minus liabilities on these properties?
So our current net worth is $1.4 million, and we have $747,000 in liabilities. And that $747,000 is primarily the mortgages we have on those two rental properties. The properties are appraised for $630,000 and $525,000 right now, so about $1.15 million. So in those rental properties, we have about $450,000 in equity. We also have $150,000 in a brokerage and Roth IRAs, and then another $100,000 in our 401k or TSP for the government. So in total, we have about a $672,000 net worth definitely a huge majority of that came from the equity of these rental properties. And that was just like the forced appreciation of fixing up the properties. I mean, the net worth is awesome, right? But really, the reason we did these rental properties is to get those rental income. So we have $100,000 in rental income. And that's great, you know, $100,000. But really, you know, when everything is said and done, all we're getting net profit from that $100,000 is $20,000 a year. And that's because of the expenses. You know, we have about $10,000 on each property for taxes. So that's $20,000 minus for properties, minus $40,000 just for the mortgage, and then minus another $20,000, let's say, for the utilities, insurance, and any maintenance expenses. So about $80,000 in expenses a year with about $100,000 in rent coming in. So, you know, net profit of $20,000 a year. But the big benefit is we get to live for free. And we have some other activities right now that we're going to increase that rent, because anything we do now to increase rent is gravy on top, because, you know, we've net profiting $20,000. Anything else we can get more in rent is just gravy.
Right. And so that's the big piece of this, is like, you can't overestimate what a benefit it is to live rent free. So, you know, without having that rent expense, what does your life actually cost?
So yeah, we're very frugal people, and I track all my expenses, you know, all my reoccurring expenses I've listed out. And for personal expenses, that amounts to around $27,000 a year. And that includes like health insurance, dental insurance, life insurance, my gym membership, my phone, internet, car insurance. All those things amount to around $27,000 in annual expenses. So that's annual recurring expenses. But I track my budget separately. So we allocate ourselves around $2,000 a month, a monthly budget for any out-of-pocket expenses. So that's separate from the recurring expenses. And that's $1,000 for groceries, and then $1,000 for my wife and I to share. So I get $500 a month to spend on whatever I want, but that includes gas and eating out and anything like that. So she gets $500 at the beginning of the month. I get $500 at the beginning of the month. And we track that, you know, we track that $2,000 a month that we're budgeting. And from, you know, knowing our recurring expenses and from knowing our monthly budget, we know exactly what we're spending a year. And because we know exactly what we're spending a year and we know exactly what we're bringing in, we know our annual savings rate. And our annual savings rate right now is around $66,000 a year.
All right, Sonny. So that was great detail. And you're 88.92% approximately to buy, right? As I'm hearing your numbers, you've got 27,000 of fixed costs, but that doesn't include, obviously, the property taxes or rent that it would be on normally living in a very high cost of living area, right?
Correct. Because that's $110,000 total in expenses then.
Yeah. Right. Because that's built into the business, right? So you said you had a 20K profit from these two rental properties, or, you know, these not two doors, but the two multifamily units that you have. But that's after building into that additional profit that would have been your personal rent. I mean, that's there. So you're at 27K for expenses. And then you said you have 24,000 approximately, including this $500 a month for each of you. As I'm hearing it, that's about 51,000 for your total budget. But there's some slack in there, right? Like, obviously, I'm curious, like, where that 88.92 comes in. Is it based on that $51,000 budget, or is it based on a number that's slightly less than that, assuming you don't have that extra $1,000 a month? Talk us through, from an engineer's perspective, how do you calculate that 88.92?
Basically, to get financially independent, you need to meet all your current expenses. Combined everything, including our expected income tax this year, we're expecting around $139,000 in annual expenses. And that sounds like a huge number, but that's because we're paying two mortgages, two property taxes, and things like that. In order to become 100% financially independent, I need to make passively $139,000. And by passively, I mean my brokerage accounts, my Roth IRAs, and my TSP. 4% of that has to either be worth that, 4% returns on that, because, you know, we all know the 4% rule. If we take 4% out of our retirement accounts, that should be enough to live on, expecting an 8% return or 7% return. So I combine the 4% rule plus my passive income. So my rental, my gross rental income right now is $103,000. So $103,000 plus 4% of my brokerage accounts and my retirement accounts equals some number divided by my total expense. And that number is at 88% financial independence rate.
Yes. Okay. I got it. So the $139K is total all-in costs, including on the properties.
Right.
You're getting $103,000 in gross rent.
Right.
So we're at $36K. And that's basically what you're building the 4% rule off of. So it's probably about $900,000 in net worth with, like you said, with your TSP, 401k and taxable accounts. That's what I'm hearing as a calculation. Does that sound about right?
Yes. I mean, I do subtract, you know, once I do reach financial independence and I'm retired, I'm not going to be paying a lot of income tax or Social Security. So I have subtracted those. So it's a little lesser amount. But yes, primarily that's accurate.
Man, we're several minutes in to this podcast and I feel like there's more, man. I'm curious just... I mean, you guys are going to hit financial independence. You're likely going to hit that number by the age of 30. I mean, things just get easier. Every additional year, you continue to get more and more space. The numbers look more and more favorable, and you have the power of compounding on your side. What freedom and opportunity has this opened up for your family, decisions that you made both in your personal life, but also with your work life? I know you said you and your wife were both working at the beginning of this journey. What's your plan now?
Right. And that's what I love so much about what we've done is, you know, buying that first four family property. We had a 6 month old at the time, and my wife was working as a elementary art school teacher, and she was on maternity leave. And it was so simple for us to make the decision for her to stay at home with our son and now two sons and be a stay at home mom, because the gross rental income while we lived on the property was around $50,000. And that dollar for dollar replaced her salary. And it was a very easy financial decision. You know, we want what's best for our family. We have the financial freedom to now do that with that first rental property. And now we have those two rental properties. And eventually the goal is to be a stay-at-home family where I no longer have to work my salaried job at the DOD. And that freedom from these two rental properties is what I love so much sharing and why I tell every single person I meet, you know, buy at least a duplex.
That's awesome, man. People listening to this, they want to find out more about your story and more about your spreadsheets and just find out more about this amazing journey that you and your family are on. What is the best way for someone to connect with you and connect with your content?
So I have a blog, famvestor.com. It's like family investor, famvestor.com. And if you just want to email me, I have my email right on the contact page. So feel free to do that. I'm on the ChooseFi forums all the time. I do on ChooseFi Northern New Jersey, where I live. I do host an event, a physical event in Clifton, New Jersey, where we do a real estate meetup and investors come. And some people are just into financial freedom. So we just talk about that too.
Awesome, man. And people listening to that, maybe in the local area, you can find your local group by just going to chooseify.com/local. Find a local group in your area. Now, on most shows, that would be the end of the episode. But Sonny, on this show, we would love to give you the chance to tackle the hot seat. Are you ready for this?
Yeah, let's do it.
In a world drowning in debt and rampant consumption, trapped by the chains of lifestyle inflation, these questions highlight the secrets of those who have broken free. Welcome to the Choose FI Hot Seat.
All right, Sonny, question number one, your favorite blog that's not your own.
So I'm not actually a huge blog reader. I do have like a 45-minute commute to work, which I actually take a government-subsidized van pool to get to. So that's why I listen to a lot of podcasts. Can I just substitute with a podcast?
Of course you can.
So I'm going to have to say ChooseFi is awesome, but the first podcast I listened to that changed my life was that Bigger Pockets podcast. It was just so transformative for me, so I'm going to have to say Bigger Pockets podcast.
Awesome. And the fact that you took action on those ideas is what we want for everybody, right? I mean, that's the key to this whole thing. Information is great, but taking action on that information is transformative. All right. Question number two, your favorite article of all time. Now, this can be one that you wrote or someone else's.
Right. So again, I've read some of like Mr. Money Mustache's stuff and Mad Scientist, and I like their articles, but I am going to have to promote my own article, which I like, and I titled it Sonny Burns and the Quest for a Frugal, Fantastic, Financial Independent Future.
And that nice, was a playoff, easy, short, memorable title.
That was a play off Elon Musk's biography that came out recently. But I just love that post because it really shows that you can get financial freedom just from two house hacks. You know, we don't really want to build a huge empire. And just from these two house hacks, we're going to buy our freedom. We have plans to put an Airbnb in one of the units, and that's going to increase our rent. We're going to rent out one of the basements. And once we move out, we're going to get an additional like $30K in gross rent. So eventually, the once everything's considered, all our plans are put in place, we're going to be net profiting $117,000 a year just from these two properties alone. And that's enabling our freedom. We're $117,000 with how frugal we are, no longer living for free at that point, but $117,000, we're definitely going to be able to do whatever we want, whenever we want in our frugal means.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, to Jonathan's point earlier, it was that one hard choice that set up basically an easy life. You're going to retire at 30 and have this wonderful life with your family because you made that hard choice to live at home, live in one bedroom with your wife, and save $75,000. Isn't that amazing how just that one thing can set up your entire life?
Yeah.
And even more than that, you know, multiple times in the episode, you said, lucky me, my parents were poor. I think probably several people noted that. But what I was thinking is, lucky you, you have a functional family, a functional money family, a family that's willing to work together to win. And that's the rare part. And yes, it's you and your parents, but it's also you and your wife. Like, she's kind of the silent partner on this episode in all of these things, because she was willing to tackle the house hack with you. She was willing to move in with your parents with you. She was willing to win at life with you and make choices that at face value were hard, but look at the freedom it's opening up for both of you going down the road. So that is super inspiring for me. Question number three, your favorite life hack.
So I was going to say the library when thinking about this question, because I don't know, we love our library. You know, we have two young kids, a four-year-old and two-year-old, and it drives me crazy reading the same book over and over and over to them. So we just go to the library, we pick out 50 children's books, we bring them home, and you know, it's always a new story that I enjoy reading to them, they enjoy, and we just take advantage of our library so much. I always get audiobooks from there. They have museum passes, so you can get free museum tickets from your library. They have our story times we take advantage of. So library is definitely cool. But I also really wanted to quickly mention something really cool I think I did that's almost kind of unique. We were able to open up a Roth IRA for our son when he was just 0 years old. And right now there's $3,000 in that Roth IRA. And so that's earned income he has to earn in order to put into a Roth IRA.
All right, don't tell us how. What I want you to do, Sonny, do you want to join us on the Friday roundup this week? There's two more things that I wanted to talk about. One, how you did this, like with your son. And then two, how you sold pacifiers on Amazon for $30,000 in gross sales. Would you like to come on the show this Friday and dive into that a little bit farther?
I'm in.
All right, Sonny, question number four, your biggest financial mistake.
So when I started to get those $25,000 a year stipend checks from the government, you know, I started looking into stock markets and investing. So I opened up a brokerage account and I started buying stocks willy-nilly. And I had no idea about like IRAs or tax advantaged accounts. So I had poured all this money into a brokerage account, which actually did really well for me. You know, I was lucky enough to buy Netflix, which has since gone up like 2,600 times for me. But I also picked a lot of losers. But the biggest mistake I feel like was getting taxed at both ends. You know, I was using after tax money. And then when I take out that money, I'm going to have to pay taxes on it. As opposed to if I had just put it into a Roth IRA, I would have used after tax money. But when I take it out, it would have been tax free at retirement age. Also, you know, with Roth IRAs, you can just pull out whatever you put in contribution basis at any time. So I wish I had just earlier on learned about the Roth IRA and started maxing out those accounts earlier.
All right. And then question number five, the advice you would give your younger self.
Honestly, I'm pretty proud of where I'm at. I'm pretty proud of the action steps that my wife and I have taken. We're very happy with our lives. We're happy with everything we've done. I would have wished that, you know, I would have been a little more bolder when I was younger. And I know I sound young already at 20 years old, but I don't know. I was a very shy kid growing up. You know, in eighth grade, if you look at my yearbook picture, I'm stenciled with the name shyest kid in eighth grade. And so I was a very shy kid, but finally now, you know, I've grown out of that. But I wish I would have been more bold. I wish I would have taken more action, just showed up like I do now, just at an earlier age.
All right, Sonny, we've got one bonus question for you. What's the purchase you've made in the last, let's say, 12 months or so that's added the most value to your life?
Okay, so this is kind of unique to my situation, but not really, because anyone with, you know, military family, you know, parents, spouses, children can take advantage of this. There's something called the Armed Forces Vacations Club, AFV Club. So we bought a week vacation, but it was a BOGO deal that they run twice a year at AFVClub.com. And so a week vacation plus another week vacation for free for $370. And we were able to book a 2-bedroom unit with a full kitchen in the Outer Banks for a week, which we just used a month ago. And then next this coming December, we have a 3-bedroom in Florida with a full kitchen, all for $370. And these are really nice resorts that are there. I just think it's such a great, great deal. You know, $25 a night, we bring in my parents, her parents come, and we just have a cool multi-generational family vacation at these nice resorts for a really cheap price. We cook our own meals and just have this great environment. So I think that's definitely been a purchase I've been excited about.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your story with us. We have had an absolute blast.
Thanks for having me. It's I had a lot of fun.
Brad, I mean, we've already referenced this quote, so I feel like you don't really need to say it again, but you know, easy choices, hard life, hard choices, easy life. This is probably one of the clearest examples of that I have seen. Sonny has nothing but options going into his 30. The same period of time that I was just spent in school and paying off my student loans, he's made a few decisions with his wife that is allowing him to have nothing but options going into the future.
Yeah, I love it. This was really an interesting interview. And yeah, I mean, to imagine that, like you said, that hard choice to live at home for a couple of years, which is really not that big of a deal in the grand scheme of things, right? But, oh, I'm an adult. Oh, I'm married. I couldn't possibly live with my parents. That's what you hear from so many people. But Sonny and his wife flipped that on its head and they've changed their entire lives. Yeah, I just love how many little side hustles they have going. And it's just a cool story. So yeah, huge thanks to Sonny for coming on.
To our audience, if you got value from today's episode, and if you've been getting value from the episodes up to this point, just take 1 second and press the subscribe button on the platform you're listening to this on. Just lets the providers know you're getting value from the show and you want to be here when we produce additional content. If you want to support us in what we're doing here at ChooseFI, here are 4 easy ways. 1, leave us an iTunes review. To do that, just go to choosefi.com/iTunes. 2, use our page to sign up for travel credit cards. If you want to travel the world with miles and points instead of your hard-earned dollars, then just go to choosefi.com/cards and get started today. 3, if you're working on the milestones of FI, set up a personal capital account to track your progress and use our affiliate link. It's completely free and just go to choosefi.com/PC. P as in Paul, C as in Cat. And 4, and most importantly, find your friends, coworkers, and family members who might be open to this message and tell them about the podcast. Have them start with episode 100. It is a fantastic starting place. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth one life hack at a time.